Welcome to the latest edition of the Metacast. We have another guest who we are very excited to have here. Jessica joins us, and she's going to educate us, including me, on polylabor and what that means and what it is and the benefits and everything and how you should actually be thinking about it, because unfortunately, I think I'm not thinking about it. So I'm excited to walk away with new things to think about to be better in my journey, in my career, and as a leader. So Jessica, first things first, tell us about who you are.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, thanks first for having me here. I appreciate that. I am, that's such a loaded question. I am a leader and entrepreneur and consultant and speaker and a whole bunch of stuff. My background is in Agile, but I've been pivoting recently into more leadership-centric enterprise organizational development work. So that's sort of the space I'm in. And I definitely have one gigantic orange tabby who's going to interrupt us a bunch. That's where we are today.
Let's start with polylabor, the word that I do have to work hard to enunciate correctly. Let's just start off with the basics definition, why it matters, why people should care, and why they should be thinking about it.
Sure. So polylabor at its core means many efforts. That's how that breaks down. But it does roll off the tongue as a company name better than many efforts. So that's where that word's definition starts in. The benefits of it, the approach that we're talking about here, is an ethical approach to building a culture that accepts whole humans and understands that they don't belong to us and we don't belong to them, and that it's a collaborative negotiation of a relationship. The intention is to help organizations build a more modern cultural workplace so that they can attract the more modern, progressive workers that are coming into the workforce now. And for those that have been in the workforce a really long time, maybe make the space more enriching for them as well.
Hey, Jessica, I've known you for a little while lately, and I've known you as an Agile coach, but I know that you're not narrowly defined like that. You have broad interests. And so how did you get to polylabor? Like what was that journey like? What was the inspiration to make this pivot?
So, you know, in Agile, we've got individuals, interactions over processes and tools. And that's certainly been the space that I focus in the most. That's my niche area. I kind of dig relationships and how they work. I would call myself a psychology enthusiast. So there's a bit of that in there as well. Typically what I was helping people with was people problems, not Agile problems. There's that aspect of it. In professional life, what I noticed was we have more people problems than we do Agile problems. The second thing that's true for me is that I am polyamorous. And so I live in complex people systems, and work is a complex people system. And I started to look at the things you have to do in a polyamory life and the things you have to do in a complicated organizational life. And I was like, well, those are really similar. So polylabor came up out of that. It's a little bit of my own personal journey and a little bit of what I was seeing happening in businesses and organizations. Now, I always like to caveat this, that I'm not encouraging people to be polyamorous unless it's something they're really after. Polylabor is about non-romantic, non-sexual relationships. So I like to put that disclaimer in there because people get a little squeaky about it.
As you talk through that, I found myself like nodding very heavily of like, yeah, so much of the coaching that I end up doing as well is not like, hey, this is how you do Agile, or hey, this is the thing. It's like, okay, gosh, so this leader has a deficiency here. So how do I help them build a better relationship with their teams or peers or their leader or something like that? So you are 100% right. So much of the effort that I see and try and help organizations drive through that change is that relationship piece and how it is complex and it is difficult. And maybe that's just the reality of the situation. And it feels like, again, assuming here, that polylabor kind of leans into that, just like Agile leans into like, hey, things are going to change. So let's be ready for it. Let's be responsive. Let's like accept that that reality. So does polylabor lean in the same way that agile leans into the reality of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. It essentially leans into people are complex, and when they get together, they get more complex. And you know, organizations are gigantic, complex systems of people. And though AI is making lots of strides, it isn't running things yet or doing all the delivery yet. So we still need all those people, and I imagine people to run prompts in AI. So there's a you know, we're not getting rid of people in business, and you know, we're not well trained in communication skills as a sort of nature of growing up. We don't get that. Although I think the younger generations have it better than the rest of us. And we're not well prepared for what it takes to have healthy dynamics at that level.
I'm curious as to, like, not that I want to role play this, but what are some of the targets you would play with a client? Like of a kind of, you know, polylabor, right? I call up Jessica Katz, call. I Zoom or something. No one calls anyone. Right. So, and I'm not, you know, what kinds of problems could I bring to you? And you had talked about helping me with those. What are some of the common, maybe scenarios that you envision that you would be helping real CTOs, like real leaders who don't know much about Agile, don't know much about human dynamics, et cetera.
Yeah. The general, I would say the consistent and persistent problem at every level that I'm usually working with is creating leadership into a team. That often they're off, you know, the CEO's doing the CEO things and all their C people are off doing other things. And they're not actually collaborating on the shared problem of strategy. And they're, you know, underutilizing their people and their, you know, the millions of other wastes things that are happening in there. But it can feel really squishy for people. So they're like, oh, it's all people stuff. It's all squishy, woo-woo. So the metric I focus on is engagement, employee engagement and attrition rates. So what we see is higher engagement and lower attrition. The benefit of higher engagement is typically anything from like a 17 to 21% increase in productivity, predictability, and so on. I would encourage people to go check out the State of the American Workforce Report from Gallup that has all that data in it. And then the other thing we see with lower attrition rates is we retain tribal knowledge. And when we retain tribal knowledge, we have less loss of time and energy trying to orient people to what has been. And we tend to lose less intellectual property.
I like that entry point. I mean, does that mean like HR would be an entry point as well? As when I think of Agile, I think of technical leadership, it mostly is a lead as an entry point for a coach or a consultant. This sounds like it might be more general purpose or something. Am I reading that right?
You are absolutely reading that right. I am. I'm pivoting away from Agile into general movements inside culture. So the HR, learning and development, if they want a leadership development program, C-suite, those are the places. If there's an executive who's like really nailed it, like the culture is really good and their division has fantastic, is fantastic in both engagement and attrition, and the rest of the company wants to emulate it, I'm a good helper to pivot that into the rest of the organization.
So I'm listening to this and I'm like, man, Jessica keeps saying some like really good stuff. How do I know that I need your help? What are some of the things that I might look around and say, like, gosh, maybe I'm not as good as I thought I was? So is it that, hey, I should look at my employee engagement and attrition, and if those aren't good, then I need to call? Or like, or are there other like common signals that I might see? Like maybe we haven't done a good job as a company tracking those. So like I can come up with anecdotal stuff, but are there other things that organizations or leaders commonly struggle with that cause some of those challenges?
Psychological safety inside the organization will be all low as well. And as we know from tons of studies now, psychological safety is your critical point for productivity and effectiveness. So low productivity, Now the question there is it lower than you want it to be, or is it really where it's supposed to be? That's a different conversation for leaders, but that can be a measurement to look at. If you're solving the problems that the board wants and not that the customers want, that's probably a signal, because this is employee focused for sure, but also community focused. So we're going to be focusing on our customers and the impact we have to the communities that we're in, which makes everybody feel better about being involved in the organization. Those are definitely some signals. If you've got employees complaining, I forget what the name of the site is, but there's a site where people can complain anonymously about the companies they work. Glassdoor is one of them. There's another one though. At any rate, they can complain about their companies. And if one of the complaints is, the C-suites are taking these gigantic bonuses and we're making a pittance and can't even survive, that's probably, you've got a bunch of people inside your organization living on survival. So that would be another signal to look for. Now, that's a painful signal to look for if you're a C-suite. That means you might have to let go of some bonus. Instead of these gigantic wide ranges between what the C-suite makes and what the individual contributors make, and just sort of squeeze it in a little bit. Promise you'll still make plenty of money, but that's the idea, is we want to squeeze that in. So those are some signals to look for. If you do an engagement survey and you get a low engagement in the survey itself, that means people don't feel like you're doing anything to make any changes and or don't feel safe to say what they need to say. So those are some places to look as well.
Do you help folks that are non-leaders that they're in an organization and they like reach out and like, Jessica, help. Like, I have no idea what to do. I'm in an organization. I love the company. I love the mission. I love the people I work with, but like, it's a disaster. And I'm like, just not as happy as I could be. Like, does someone like that also have an option to help make this change?
Yeah, absolutely. I do individual coaching all the time and can help them strategize. And if you're an individual contributor, unless you build a grassroots effort with a lot of individual contributors, the leadership isn't going to hear you. As we saw in Agile, and we see basically in all major change efforts, if you don't bring both ends in, then the change doesn't take, because change requires individual transformation of thought. And you got to get all the individuals over the hump. So that's something to consider as well. And I want to just caveat this with, while it's true you may be trying to combat things like engagement and attrition, when you make a major cultural shift, you'll also see an increase in attrition and a decrease in engagement during the change, because change is hard and uncomfortable. So any change efforts, we can make them better, collaborative, engaging, have people feel like they're part of the process instead of being told what to do. It does a lot in those spaces.
I mean, where my brain, I'm sort of stuck in a place where I'm thinking about leaders asking for help. And that doesn't happen in my experience that often. So they're gaining entry. Like, how do you gain entry to introduce poly-labor activities? One of the things I think about, Jessica, is that like culture shaping is a term that comes to mind. To my mind with this, I think of like, shaping or reshaping the culture, but how do you gain that entry? And I'm not looking for an answer. How do we get leaders to ask for help? How do we get them to recognize, just because the charts, if I have an attrition rate, I've worked with, I don't know how many leaders, it's like, it's not their problem. It's the employees, get out of here. It's the rat problem. It's not a leadership problem. So how do we turn the leaders around?
Yeah, if there's a leader in that mindset, it's a rat problem, not a leader problem, they're not my customer.
Okay.
That is just a true fact. If they're busy, I worked with a CIO once who got the engagement surveys back, and one of the comments on it was, leadership sucks. That was the only comment. That's a really powerful comment. And he justified it. He's like, oh, they didn't understand the question. This isn't helpful, and completely ignored it. That's not my target audience.
Okay.
My target audience understands there's a problem and is looking to change the soil before blaming the flower. Which is a pull on an analogy I'm sure we've all seen before, where, you know, if the flower doesn't grow, blame the soil, not the flower. And the leadership is the soil. So we need leadership to be in a healthy space, to be aligned, to be culturally thinking about how do they make an awesome environment for their employees. And you're not going to find, you're not going to go into an organization and find every leader in that headspace. But if you've got the right leader with the right influence in that headspace, we can make that shift. And it doesn't have to be the whole company. We could start with a division or a department, and make changes and then use the outcomes of those changes to influence the rest of the company.
So that's very little to do. I mean, maybe I'm coming to the party late. That has nothing to do with Agile. To me, that's leadership. And you said this, leadership centric and organizational centric to me, system centric. And leveraging your coaching skills, your general coaching skills and your system skills in order to come in and change those leaders. And they need to be receptive to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the overlap with agility is that Agile coaches know this already. They've been there because Agile was a cultural shift in an organization. It wasn't a process shift, even though often it was approached that way. It's a cultural shift. It's a people shift. And this is a different people shift.
Well, it's solving that bigger problem that all Agile coaches see, right, and bounce off of to some degree. What are some common leadership patterns that you've seen? Like that, and we don't want to be triggered, we don't want to be stuck in the patterns, but, you know, what are some common leadership mistakes or patterns that you help them to change or to shift?
A really big one that we try and move through is the awareness of bias and power. Folks at leadership, they're like, well, I'm the C-suite, they should just do what I say. I get that kind of conversation a lot. But they don't belong to you. They aren't your children. They aren't required to listen to you. Right? So we're going to shift that dynamic to a space of shared conversation. How might we negotiate with these people to come on to this thing? And are you open to hearing where they think you're wrong? Because they have a perspective you don't, just like you have a perspective they don't. And so we're really moving into that perspective shifting towards shared community building instead of shared product building, shared whatever building, instead of I tell you what to do and you do it, or I influence you to do what I say. And because I have power, you're going to do it because you're afraid you might lose your job, right? We're trying to move away from that space. Some other patterns I've seen, why do my employees keep bringing me problems? I want them to have solutions, right? Like that was one of my favorites. I'm like, well, because they don't know how to solve it. Like that's why they've come to you. So let's collaborate on it. And often there's an aspect of teaching leadership how to have good coaching skills so that they can ask the right questions and enable people to come to their own conclusions and get out of the way, red tape in an organization, bureaucracy in organization is often built because somebody somewhere behaved badly and we didn't deal with the behavior. We just made a process to get around it. So, a good introspection on what processes are actually serving us and how do we evaluate these regularly, so we're not living with 50-year-old policies that no longer are relevant, that sort of thing.
You know, as you mentioned, the first challenge, like, I could just like in my brain, I saw and heard former leaders that I worked for just responding to like, well, I'm paying them to do a job. So like, that's the reward they get, you know, is the payment. I just can imagine having that conversation with some of the people that I worked with in the past that I quickly moved on from. But yeah, there were a few in my day where like that was like, because I'm paying you, yes, you're going to do what I said. And I was like, well, okay, then maybe you're just going to stop paying me because I won't be here.
Right. Then we get into all those other problems. We lose the tribal knowledge. We lose the skill. We have to retrain people. And it costs a lot of money to replace people. Yeah. So there's that aspect as well. And I am. What you're paying people for is not to do a job. You're paying people to participate in the purpose of your organization. And that participation is negotiable from both sides. Personally, I live in a right to work state. So, people are allowed to quit without giving notice. Now, there's often a consequence for that socially in finding the next job. They're allowed to quit without giving notice, just like you're allowed to fire them without giving notice. So that's like one of the places where you have an imbalance, often a power imbalance. Because you're an organization, you get to give me no notice. And because I'm a person, I have to give you 2 weeks or else I won't be able to find another job. That's the kind of imbalances we see.
Can you... I know you can. I don't know why I started that. Like, can you? For the viewers and listeners that are out there that maybe don't feel empowered by all the words that you just said about the actual rights they have, and that it isn't just a right, but like you're choosing to work there. You're choosing to dedicate your time, effort, and energy, and like a lot of your heart and soul to like helping this mission become a thing. Are there things that you can share to help those folks out there feel more confident about taking that stance and understanding that, yes, I actually have a say in this matter?
Yeah. My very first recommendation to people when they're really nervous about being in that space is to build themselves an F-off fund. An F-off fund is however many months of expenses that you need to feel confident to say, I'm out of here. And if you can say I'm out of here, then they can say you're fired, and neither one of those are painful. So that's the first thing I recommend to people. And that requires people to be at a standard of living where they can afford to put aside money. So if they're way down in the individual contributor space and barely making it, my recommendation actually is to go hit the market and see what they can find. Because most of the time you'll make more money leaving a company than staying. All right, so that's sort of the bad news, right? That's the good news on this is that as an individual contributor, start small. If you've got a leader who isn't right now creating an environment for you, start negotiating it. And it could look like this. I'm not getting a lot of value out of our one-on-ones. Would you be open to discussing how we better use this time? That's just a small step to make the environment better for you. Right? And it's a little thing. But it makes your relationship with your leader better.
The first, 20 years of my career, I'll give myself a little bit more credit, 15 years of my career, I was not good at coaching up. And so having those conversations was something that I was not good at. And I can remember spending time with Bob trying to get coached on how to coach up because I was having challenges like that where I wasn't getting anything out of that, and I didn't feel like that person, that role was helping me achieve my goals. So part of it was like, well, do I just need to go somewhere else, or can I help change this? Because there's really great things about the job. There's just like this one thing that was kind of bothering me. So that is a skill, and it's not something which you said pretty early on is like, you aren't taught these things. They aren't like, it's not like you go to school and you get like, here's how you coach up, like that stuff that doesn't exist. So you have to find it on your own, which can be a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It is something I coach on though. So if there are individual contributors out there that just want some one-on-one coaching, I'm down for it. Cool. As does Bob, apparently. So
no, I'm giving thumbs up to you being a coach. I would say yes. talk to Jessica. As we're exploring this, I'm thinking of Dan Mizek popped into my mind, and I don't know if you know Dan. He has this notion of open space agility, and when I think of him, I think of invitation. He's like, the godfather of inviting rather than prescribing, but inviting people in. Inviting people to join a project rather than assigning them to a team, things like that. How much of that plays in your thinking or your leadership evolution, Jessica? Anything?
A lot. I am deeply entrenched in consent culture. I want to make cultures that are consentful, which means every action should be a choice, and we want to make it as conscious as possible. If it's unconscious, like, well, my boss might have to do this, so I'm doing it, right? That's an unconscious sort of, I'm just an implicit expectation that I have to say yes because my boss asked for it. If we go in as a leader and say things like, I have this piece of work, what are your priorities? How can I help support this? Is this something you feel confident doing? Do you need any other support? And you're really creating an environment where the person has the ability to confidently say yes to work. Then we've moved into the space of consent. You know, people, it is true that you're paying people to get results and participate in the mission that you're driving towards. But that doesn't mean they have to kill themselves for it. You know, companies that are like, I can't afford to pay X number of dollars and run a business or probably shouldn't be running a business. They need to figure out how to pay people enough. You know, some of the some leaders that I find have made really good choices in their business are ones that have decided to take a personal loss to create an environment for their employees. And it eventually pays back. It does take a minute. You have to take a personal loss for a hot minute, but it's worth it in the long run.
Cool. I like that.
I will say it's also easier to do if you're a privately owned company. If you're publicly traded, it becomes much harder.
Yeah. One of the things that I have run into is, and I really liked earlier on, you talked about symptoms of leadership team basically doing what the board says. And I've really seen as that first large investment comes into a company, what I've seen is it takes 12 to 18 months for that leadership team to like figure out how to work with the board, as opposed to having the board be the tail that's wagging the dog. Whereas so many places I've been in that first year, it's like, we're just blindly doing what the board says or ask. They ask, but it's really saying. And so there's been a lot of coaching that I've done that I think this approach could really help reframe that relationship as well. Are there things, thoughts you have about how to support leaders that are maybe going through that and maybe feel like they've lost their way a little bit and they've lost a little bit of control? Because that's something that I've seen leaders have to work through and kind of stumble their way through. And then that 18 month thing, they realize like, oh, wait a minute. Like, we are the operators of this company, not the board. The board has thoughts and ideas and all those things, but like, no one knows it like we do because we operate the darn thing.
Yeah. That feeling, I want leaders who've experienced that to just reflect on that for just a minute, because that feeling is what your individual contributors go through every time you shift strategy. And if they're experiencing that, they now get deep empathy for their employees. So that's the first step I want to talk through. The second thing I want to talk through is they can establish a working agreement with their board. What decision-making agreements are they having? How do they come to decisions? What kinds of decisions does the board need to weigh in on? What are they there just as a consultant role? You know, I do think it's worth it. You know, that show where the boss comes and pretends to be an employee of a company, Undercover Boss, I think it is.
Yeah.
I really wish that folks at the top would occasionally go work inside their company and just remember what it's like to be inside the company, beholden to other people. Because it, you know, you forget it quickly. The board has a perspective that's valuable, but their perspective is about the market and about making money. And that's a profit conversation. That's not a purpose or mission driven conversation. So another option might be when you go public, or maybe now that you're public, you want to shift your focus, is to move to something called a B Corp. And a B Corp is a purpose driven organization, purpose over profit. That isn't to say we're not going to make profit. In fact, what we find in data is that if you focus on purpose, you're likely to make more profit. When you focus on engagement, your board is likely to make more money, 3 to 4 points higher in the stock market. So there are solid benefits, but you have to do a little bit of selling to the board if you don't have somebody with that mindset buried in. But maybe a board member whose focus is culture could be beneficial, or a chief culture officer could be beneficial. Somebody who's really looking at, they're basically like the Jiminy Cricket in those spaces, looking at that aspect and being a devil's advocate for the way we're doing things.
Man, you pulled in a Jiminy Cricket reference. Job well done. Like, that is solid.
Maybe that's how we land the episode. We land the episode on Jiminy Cricket.
I don't know how to top that. That was really good. Okay, so For everybody that's watching and or listening and found yourself just like me, nodding along to so many of the things that Jessica has said, what is the best way for them to reach out and say, like, Jessica, you're freaking awesome. How do I get you to come help me and my company? How do they do that?
Yeah, well, they can find me on LinkedIn. That's the place I'm most active. They can go to my website, polylabor.com. There's a contact form. Also, if they just want to keep an eye on what I'm doing, there's a newsletter to sign up for there. Those are the best routes to get to me. But just don't call me without knocking first, you know? Send me a message. Send me a message, and then let's set up time to talk instead of coming to the house unannounced.
I like it.
Yeah.
Hey, all right. Hey, Josh.
Yeah.
I have a final question for the three of us. Ooh. I think this may be my question that I forgot earlier. I don't know. So I hope so.
We'll so, understand it.
So if what's our elevator pitch for this Metacast? I want to hear the one sentence or very brief elevator pitch, the high point, the key drop the mic point for the last 30 plus minutes that folks have spent with us from our different perspectives. And I can go first because I have something that I wrote down that was really, I thought.
Cheating here. Like you had the answer before. Yeah,
but I'm giving you time. Consent-based leadership. What really powerfully resonated with me for any leaders listening is this notion that Jessica talked about extending consent or establishing consent. That's still running around my brain and really resonating well of trying to layer that into the culture. So consent-based leadership, and actually I put rocks, but I don't know. I haven't validated that it rocks yet, but it sounds like it rocks.
I don't have a good, concise, like pithy one-liner, but what I know, sorry, Bob. One of the things that I really liked was when I asked the question about the boards and Jessica's response around that feeling you have, that's how your employees feel. I'd like to do a better job of wrapping words around that because everybody has that feeling. Everybody knows what that is. And then that recognition of, oh my gosh, I'm causing that emotion within a significant portion of the people that work at this company that I lead. Yikes. I need to make some changes. So something around that, something about those feelings that you feel and recognizing that that is likely rippling through your organization. And there are things and ways. And as we have learned, there are people like Jessica that are experts at helping you navigate that problem.
Cool. Jessica, your elevator pitch for yourself.
Yeah, my elevator pitch, I'm going to cheat and just tell you my tagline. So that is to build consent, inspire talent, and lead effectively. That is my...
Say that again, please.
Okay. Build consent, inspire talent, lead effectively.
Oh, my God. So from beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina.
And beautiful downtown Fuquay Varina, North Carolina.
And beautiful suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee.
I'm Bob Galen.
I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Jessica Katz.
All right.
Shake
and make.
Take care, y'all.
Right. Man, she even did the exploding rock.
She did. Oh, my God. Nailed it.